At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Billionaire businessman Warren Buffett this weekend weighed in hard against the sky-high U.S. deficit and the falling dollar. America may want to be an ownership society, Buffett said, but it's heading down the road to a sharecropper society. But some believe that Buffett and his alarmed camp are just fear-mongering. Don't bet against America's economic standing, they say. Others are not so sure and warn that the U.S. is standing at the edge of a nasty financial precipice. Tonight on Point, we dive into the debate over high deficits, the low dollar, and the future of the American economy. But first, we begin tonight in Lebanon. The militant Shiite group Hezbollah has called for national demonstrations to begin tomorrow in Beirut against foreign powers it said were trying to expel Syria from Lebanon. Tomorrow's demonstration will be near the same square where anti-Syria protesters have staged round-the-clock demonstrations since the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Scott Wilson has been covering the story for The Washington Post. I asked him why we can expect throngs of Shiites in Beirut streets tomorrow.
Well, yesterday, the head of Hezbollah, which is an armed Shiite political movement in Lebanon, called for demonstrations, essentially counter-demonstrations to what we've been seeing for the past couple weeks in the streets since former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri was assassinated. The head of Hezbollah was careful not to call them pro-Syrian rallies, but they are meant to make a point, which is that the withdrawal of Syrian troops from bases around Beirut to the eastern Bekaa Valley should be allowed to keep its guns, which are a legacy of Lebanon's long civil war.
You're saying Hezbollah should be allowed to keep its guns?
That's right. Hezbollah essentially was a militia that emerged during Lebanon's civil war, has kept its weapons, and it's sort of and battles Israel from time to time in South Lebanon along the border.
Why does Hezbollah's Shiite leader want to keep Syria engaged in Lebanon?
Syria acts as kind of a gatekeeper for Hezbollah's guns and money, which come from Iran. Iran is sort of the spiritual leader of Shiism in this part of the world. Hezbollah draws its inspiration as well as guns and money from Iran. Syria, with a very large military and intelligence presence in Lebanon, allows for Hezbollah to receive those supplies. Those supplies are then used largely in the 1990s as resistance to the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon, and now as what they call a defense of South Lebanon, although many people are asking, including the United Nations, that Hezbollah give up its guns.
So what do we have emerging here? Do we see a split within the Lebanese population itself over whether Syria should stay or go? And what does the split look like?
Yeah, a very big split. What we've seen so far since Hariri's murder has been largely a playing field dominated by Lebanon's opposition. Christian, Druze, and Sunni parties, very angry who blame Syria for Hariri's death. This has sort of been the tipping point of a long antagonism since the Israeli occupation ended in 2000, that Syria and its proxy army in the south, Hezbollah, end its militancy and influence.
Now, Syria said today it filled out some more details on Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian leader's comments over the weekend. It said that by the end of this month, they would pull their some 14,000 troops back to the border region. Does this satisfy the Lebanese critics of the Syrian presence?
Not at all. The Lebanese critics want Syria out now completely. Syria has 15,000 troops here and a very large intelligence presence here. And the Lebanese opposition has called for that to be gone now. Those calls also are being made by the Bush administration, France, the UN Security Council. And so it's sort of a midway kind of an offer that President Assad is making to try to get out from pressure. that is being put on him by the international community, including important Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, that he quit Lebanon now.
But the Shiites that Hezbollah draws its strength from form a plurality of Lebanon's 4 million people. Could we be headed here toward a reopening of the civil strife that destroyed much of Beirut not so many decades ago?
There's definitely going to be an emergence of civil strife. Whether or not that becomes armed civil strife is something else. Everyone is hoping it doesn't at this point. But you're going to see hundreds of thousands of people in the streets tomorrow. Frankly, even Lebanese opposition figures will tell you flat out that Hezbollah is going to get a lot more people in the streets than they get in the streets. And so you are going to see a sort of almost a democratic display, in a way, in tomorrow's public protest of a lot of Shiite Muslims who feel that Syria has been good for this country and that its continuing presence would be good for this country in light of what they feel as a UN, U.S., French persecution of Syria.
But unclear at the moment whether we're seeing a kind of flowering of democracy or something much more strife-filled there.
Exactly. Right now, you're certainly seeing something much more strife-filled. The Lebanese opposition would tell you this is a struggle for liberation from Syrian domination. Hezbollah would tell you this is a U.S.-Israeli plan to bring in a pro-Western government, a pro-Israeli government in a part of the world that still is very hostile to that idea. And so you are going to see a lot of strife probably over the next few weeks at least. Most people here, I think, are hoping that doesn't become an armed struggle.
Scott Wilson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Wilson is a correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Beirut, Lebanon. Billionaire investment guru Warren Buffett dropped a couple of bombs this weekend in his annual letter to investors. He said his company, Berkshire Hathaway, scored a $1.6 billion take in the last 4 months of 2004 by betting against the U.S. dollar. The dollar is set for an even deeper slump, he said. Even worse, Warren Buffett warned that an exploding U.S. trade deficit, combined with the withering dollar, is putting America at risk of turning into a sharecropper society, not an ownership society, but a nation tempting a severe economic comeuppance. The Buffett broadside is the latest loud cry in an already heated debate over whether the United States is tempting an economic meltdown. Skeptics are not buying it and say American economic overstretch is a myth. Others are warning of big trouble. Tonight on Point, the great debate over the fundamental stability of the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation. Do the record U.S. trade deficits worry you? Or will the world underwrite American debt forever? Is the country risking a meltdown? Or is that scenario a myth, a scary story? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Syracuse, New York, is Stuart Brown, professor of economics and international relations at Syracuse University. He is co-author, along with David Levy, of an essay appearing in the latest issue of Foreign Affairs magazine entitled The Overstretch Myth. Stuart Brown, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's good to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Stuart Brown, you've got your very provocative thesis. It's right on the cover of the magazine. I'm sure you've had a lot of feedback since this came out. What are you hearing in your academic sphere, in the many spheres that intersect with this question? Are people buying your notion that it's an overstretched myth?
Well, I would say that quite a few people disagree. I mean, we are against the consensus here. You mentioned Warren Buffett's comments. It's hard to bet against Warren Buffett. I would agree with him that the dollar will decline over the next few years. In fact, that's nothing new. That's not a surprise. But I would not agree with him that this means that the U.S. economy is really in the doldrums or that it's going in the wrong direction. It's fundamentally a very productive economy.
We've got to define our terms here, I think. People warn about a meltdown, about an Argentine-style or Brazilian-style or Turkish-style slide. Are you saying that can't happen, or are you saying even if that are you conceding it could happen, but even on the other side of that, the United States will still be number one?
Well, I think the comparison with Argentina is completely off the charts. You know, Argentina did not have the world's leading currency. The United States is able to issue debt in its own currency. That gives it a tremendous advantage. Argentina was not at the technological frontier as the United States is. And as bad as the budget deficit forecast in the United States is, it's nothing like it was in Argentina with interest rates going sky high. So I just don't think the comparison makes any sense whatsoever.
But what you're essentially saying is that when you go through all the scenarios here, in every one you look at, that's likely in your view, the United States remains the economic hegemon, to use your word.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's no question that the trade deficit is large and that there will be an adjustment. And it's not, by the way, a U.S. problem. It's a global problem. Everybody's got to adjust in their own way. And I'm including in that China, Europe, Japan, as well as the United States. But that trade deficit can come down in a much smoother fashion than your question implies in reference to Argentina. The dollar will decline. We all know interest rates will be moving up. The federal chairman has indicated that for some time. That does not mean that the U.S. will be in any inferior position politically or influentially in the globe.
Jack Beatty, it comes as something new to have the contrarian voice saying the United States is going to stay strong, large, and in charge. But that's exactly what Stuart Brown is in many ways at this point.
Well, of course, Dr. Pangloss, all's for the best in the best of all possible worlds, was an economist. And you know, the other day, the Financial Times columnist began with a list of very exotic names. And I wondered, who are these people? Well, it turns out that these people are essentially the arbiters of our economic destiny, or at least that's what the column alleged. They're the bank officials abroad and the revenue officials. And when it suddenly it dawned on me, our elected officials are no longer at the controls of the master levels of the economy, the foreign governments and bankers that are floating us. They're the ones in power. They have control of our economic destiny. That's frightening just all by itself.
So vote for whoever you like, but look to the finance minister in Beijing, in Seoul, in Tokyo. Stuart Brown, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking tonight about America's high deficit, low dollar meltdown scenario and whether it's real, a real and present danger or a paranoid myth. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's high deficit, low dollar meltdown scenario and whether it is a real and present danger or a paranoid myth. You can join the conversation tonight. Who's got it right? Warren Buffett, when he warns of a debt-strapped America becoming a sharecropper society, or those who see meltdown warnings as part of a myth of American overstretch? Is the country speeding toward an economic precipice or so globally essential that it cannot topple? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our own Jack Beatty is with us tonight, along with Stuart Brown, professor of economics and international relations at Syracuse University. His article in the current cover of Foreign Affairs magazine is The Overstretch Myth. And joining us now from Washington is Robert Aliber. He's a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, professor of international economics and finance at the University of Chicago, and author of The Dollar's Day of Reckoning, an article appearing in the latest issue of the Wilson Quarterly. Robert Aliber, thank you for being with us.
Great to be here.
So here we are. We've got dueling headlines and big dueling essays behind them. You're talking about a day of reckoning. Stuart Brown and David Levy talking about the overstretch myth. What's the reckoning that you're concerned about, Robert Aliber?
Our external debt has been growing three times as rapidly as our GDP. We violated a limit theorem. If Mr. Brown and Mr. Levy won the lottery, $1 million or $10 million, would they buy U.S. dollar securities or yen securities or euro securities? Professor Brown has already said that the dollar is going to depreciate. It's hard to make the case that any investor would buy a currency that is likely to depreciate at 3, 4, or 5% a year when the interest rate differential is very, very modest.
Now, that's clearly the case that Warren Buffett is making, and we're going to get Stuart Brown's reply to this, but so that everybody understands what we're talking about, including me, would you describe the meltdown scenario that people are worried about? What would it look like, Robert Aliber?
Yes, the dollar begins to depreciate. It begins to depreciate at an accelerating rate. The momentum-based hedge funds begin to short the dollar. the Federal Reserve has to respond, and the Federal Reserve raises interest rates. Long-term bond rates go to 6-7%. That's going to kill the bubble in the housing market, and that's going to move the Dow to the range of 7,000 to 8,000. That means a significant recession in the U.S. economy. That's the meltdown.
And is that a fiasco, or is that just another recession? We've been through recessions before.
It's a severe recession.
I guess people talk about Argentina, they talk about Brazil. We've seen what that looked like. Just looked like a Great Depression practically at certain points in Argentina. Are we risking that, or are we risking the kind of experience that Americans have had before in their lifetimes, Great Depression aside, and survived? Thank you.
Well, the country will survive. It's a great country. The meltdown will not be as severe as the one in Argentina, but there is one significant difference, and that was highlighted by Professor Brown, and that is there are going to be very severe adjustments in the countries that have trade surpluses, the counterpart of our trade deficits, that are too large to be sustainable. So in contrast to the Argentina scenario, this is going to be a global meltdown. Business will grow slowly. Economic activity will be much slower, both in the United States and in the countries that now have the excessively large trade surpluses.
And what do you think the odds of this happening are? Is it 50-50 at this point, Robert Aliber, or is
it's 120%.
We are going to hit this wall.
We will hit this wall unless we go to Lourdes and there's a miracle.
Let me ask you one final thing. I'll turn to Stuart Brown and we'll come back to you then. But do you see this on the other side of this, if it hits everybody equally, one thing that Stuart Brown and David Levy are saying is the United States will remain the global economic hegemon, because while it might take some pain for a while, so will everyone else. We end up on top. Do you agree?
Well, we're a very large country. We have a very high GDP. But when this shock occurs, when this inevitable shock occurs, economic activity in the United States is going to slow at a very rapid rate. It will slow around the world, and then the question will be, will our friends in foreign countries trust us as much after this shock as they did before? We have abused our role as the protector of the store of value for dollar assets.
Stuart Brown, there's the case. Robert Aliber says we're going to hit the wall. It's a 120% certainty, and when we do, it'll be very economically painful, and our leadership role will be questioned anew, maybe severely, by those who have followed for many years. What do you say?
Well, I first say that I would not put 120% probability on what is called a hard scenario, certainly something well under 100%. I'm not excluding that possibility as a possibility, but I don't think that's the most likely scenario. The other thing to keep in mind, it seems to me, is that private investors have already in the last couple of years been diversifying out of dollars. And most of the treasuries, for example, that have been purchased by foreign investors have been central banks in recent years. They take a very different view than private investors do about the accumulation of foreign exchange reserves, which they hold in U.S. treasuries. They do not have to mark to market like private investors do. They have those reserves in the case of an emergency. They have in mind the recent Asian financial crisis when those countries were forced to devalue because they didn't have enough reserves. So, China's position about a declining dollar and its response with respect to what it should do with its dollar investments is rather different than the response of private investors. Mm. Having said that, I think private investors, including U.S. investors, will be coming back.
You're talking hedge funds and others.
Hedge funds and other types of investors, whether foreign or U.S. The U.S. investors have a lot of money, $4 trillion abroad. They can bring some of that back as the adjustment in the dollar takes place and as interest rates rise, as Professor Aliber correctly said they would. I just don't see a doomsday scenario. I see more of a market adjustment. It may be a tough one. It will involve a slowdown all over the world, including in the United States, but nothing of the magnitude that Professor Aliber is alleging.
Well, that's what I want to ask. Both of you are saying, look, the U.S. is not Argentina. On the other hand, Robert Aliber is saying, we're going to hit a wall here. It's inevitable. You're saying that we will end up the economic hegemon in spite of that. But you too, Stuart Brown, are saying that there could be a tough adjustment out there. Plunging stock and bond prices, a sharp break in the markets, real tough times for U.S. consumers and workers. So is it so different from what you're describing? Is that, in fact, a kind of meltdown that we should be, working our tails off to avoid?
Well, I agree with Professor Aliber that the current account deficit is large and it's essentially unsustainable, and that there has to be an adjustment. But one of the reasons that is used to describe why we got in this mess in the first place is that U.S. consumers are profligate, our government is profligate, and I don't think that really is the essence of what happened. In fact, we underestimate savings in this country. Personal savings is a lot higher than it's measured. Investment happens to be very strong. In fact, investment is increasing at a 14% year-on-year rate right now. So you get a current account deficit when you have strong investment and when other countries of the world are spending too little and saving too much and therefore send their surplus savings to the country which is the most productive country in the world, namely the United States. So that's why I say it's a global problem. And I suspect that the adjustments, if they're made, including the budget deficit in the United States, including labor market reforms and other reforms in Europe and Japan, and China's role in changing the value of its currency, all those things, if we can do them together, could increase the chances of a smoother recovery.
Jack Beatty, it's scary when economists make their predictions and describe scenarios for little folks like me trying to understand exactly what they're suggesting and what they're not. Warren Buffett talks in very plain language. Stuart Brown says we're not profligate. He says, Warren Buffett, that the U.S. has become rich spending junkies, and he warns that we're on a path, we're risking becoming not an ownership society, but a sharecropper society. That sounds like a pretty tough comeuppance to me.
It does, and he also said that Americans may eventually chafe, quoting him, at the idea of perpetually paying tribute to their foreign creditors, a sort of blow to the national pride. You know, all of this reduces our power. It limits our room for maneuver in foreign policy with regard to China and Taiwan, with regard to Europe. Countries that essentially are our paymasters are not countries that we over which we have the influence we had when we had a more sensible trade policy. And, you know, if you look at the trade figures last year, $600 billion trade deficit, there was a deficit of something like $20 billion in higher-end electronics. That is the stuff that we're supposed to be so good at, that our technological genius is invested. Yeah. And we ran a booming surplus, on the other hand, in the export of scrap paper. Now, I don't find any comfort in that at all. It could well be, you know, that we'll keep cheapening the dollar, but people won't buy our goods, either because it's their mercantilist policy not to, or because they don't think they're very good.
Robert Aliber, Stuart Brown says, yes, we may have a sharp blow, not as sharp as you're suggesting, and that, in fact, we're not overstretched. That's a myth. Can you see some way to get to that point of view, or that's just not in your cards?
No, it certainly isn't in my cards. We are overstretched. We're spending much more than we're earning. And we do live in a world in which we compete with a lot of countries that follow beg-thy-neighbor policies. So the difficult problem is that even though the dollar has gotten weaker and has depreciated very significantly since the year 2000, our trade deficit has increased by 20%. The textbooks that we teach from would suggest a cheaper dollar would lead to a reduction in the trade deficit. So Professor Brown has to come up with an explanation of why the decline in the foreign exchange value of the dollar has not led to a nice, smooth adjustment and made life easier eventually for Americans.
And let me ask you, and we know we have to be careful here because Warren Buffett's very upfront that he's betting against the dollar, so the more it falls, the more money he makes. But when he warns about the U.S. becoming a sharecropper society instead of the affluent or ownership society, that suggests what we see these days in political cartoons and language all over the place, a diminished U.S. standard of living, Robert Aliber, in the offing out there, in the not-so-distant future if this isn't fixed. Do you see it as that severe?
I would rephrase it to sort of say the rate of growth of the American standard of living will be diminished. There will be a decline in the American standard of living, a very brief decline when the recession occurs. But thereafter, because we're a large debtor country, our currency will be cheaper in the future. It will cost us much more when we go to Europe and Asia. We will be less affluent as tourists. and the rate of growth of our standard of living will be smaller because we will be making large payments of interest and dividends to our foreign creditors.
And American economic hegemony, as Stuart Brown and David Levy calls it, do you think that we'd still have that on the other side? We had Peter Drucker on recently. He said he anticipates the United States making a very painful adjustment to just being one of a half dozen economically powerful countries with no more clout than that. Do you see the hegemony going on or not?
Oh, yes. We will remain a hegemon, but it will be a much less powerful hegemon than we were, say, in 1995.
Stuart Brown, how about it? Robert Aliber says, how do you explain what's going on here? The dollar's down, but the trade deficit is even worse, and we won't be the kind of hegemon we once were, period.
Well, my first response is that every economist agrees that it is going to take much more than a depreciation of the dollar to greatly lower the current account deficit and the trade deficit.
Why?
No one expects the dollar to do all the work. One of the basic problems is that the U.S. economy is so fast-growing, and it's so productive, and its productivity growth is so rapid, and that's based on very, very superior technological adaptation to a whole series of products. To the extent that we continue to outgrow Europe and Japan, we will suck in their imports. And therefore, there's no way that the dollar alone would have to fall by an enormous amount beyond anything you can imagine for us to rely on that to narrow the trade deficit. Now, with respect to the dependence on China, you know, China has a dependence on us as well. And that is a much longer-term dependence. What China's dependence involves is a long-term development strategy. Mm. They've got 300 million peasants that they're trying to employ in the urban sector over the next 10, 15 years. And they've got to employ those people by creating demand. And that demand happens to come from the United States. It's American consumers buying those products.
So they peg the Chinese currency to the dollar so they can keep their product low and keep selling lots at Walmart.
That's right. That's right. And therefore, you know, they view it as they're as dependent on us as we may be on them. So there's a complementarity here between the United States and China. In fact, between the United States and Asia, which is often missed.
Does that go on perpetually?
No, it can't go on perpetually, but nor can this current account deficit. This current account deficit will eventually come down, and demand will increase, and savings will fall in other parts of the world.
If it's not a lower dollar that's going to bring down the trade deficit, in other words, make U.S. products more competitive abroad, what do you see doing that, Stuart Brown?
Well, I hope it's going to be faster growth in Europe and Japan. Because it would be a shame if we have to lower our economic growth by radically cutting back our consumption and therefore our imports of their goods in order to rectify that global imbalance. It's a superior solution if those countries, and they've been asked to do this for a long time, to adopt the tough measures, the structural reforms, which will get their economies to grow faster.
They've been pretty resistant to those reforms. Let's try and get one caller here before the break. At least Mark is calling from Windham, New Hampshire. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment. Two points, actually. Number one, where the goods are produced doesn't necessarily speak to the U.S.'s leadership in technological innovation. And so there's, you know, despite these things being produced in India and China and whatever, it's still the U.S. that owns the R&D for these products.
But we've got the trade deficit, Mark.
Clearly, but the profits still flow back to the U.S. and the corporations that are based here. And so the investors and the people who are employed by those corporations profit.
And your second point? Yep.
The trade deficit doesn't take into account the tremendous amount of management consultancy and other services that we export around the world. So as more and more countries open their markets and become more like America, you know, to what extent are those services taken into account in this trade imbalance? And, you know, doesn't America, again, benefit from a more open economy in many, many countries.
And that might change the way things look. I hear a vote of confidence in the U.S. economy from you, Mark.
Precisely.
Thanks for your call. Robert Aliber, how about it? Mark says it doesn't matter where the products are made as long as the innovation is in the USA, and he says it is.
We have a trade deficit of $600 billion. Let's assume each worker in manufacturing has value added of $100,000 a year. That's a high estimate. The trade deficit represents the loss of 6 million jobs in manufacturing. Mm. Much of that is with the Asian countries. Many of these people have moved into higher value-added activities and services, but many have moved out of the labor force or into lower value-added activities. So the trade deficit is a big drain on the American spending stream and on the growth of American income.
And so we're feeling the price, whether we believe it or not.
There have been big costs in many of the traditional Rust Belt states, big cost in many of the manufacturing centers across the United States.
Jack Beatty, even in Stuart Brown's scenario, there's room for a sharp whack here. It doesn't look fun.
It doesn't look fun, and if the rebalance takes place at a, whether if not a lower standard of living, then a lower standard of living relative to today, that's not nirvana by any means. That could be the soft landing.
Even the soft landing might have some gravel out there on the runway. Stuart Brown, Robert Aliber, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about America's high deficit, low dollar meltdown scenario and whether or not it's for real. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's high deficit, low dollar meltdown scenario and whether it is a real and present danger or a myth. My guest tonight, Stuart Brown. He's a co-author, along with David Levy, of the article in Foreign Affairs magazine in the latest issues called The Overstretched Myth, and you can tell right there what he thinks about it. Robert Aliber is also joining us tonight from Washington. He's written about the dollar's day of reckoning in the Wilson Quarterly. It looks like a tough road ahead to him. You can join the conversation tonight as well. Do you agree there is no plausible challenger to U.S. economic leadership, hegemony, as Stuart Brown would phrase it? And will the world perpetually underwrite America's debt? Does it have no choice? And when and if that changes, what then? How rough a road? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andrew is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Tom? Great show. Very complicated matters you're talking about tonight. My question and comment is not specifically targeted toward the trade deficit, but more towards the budget deficit. And I just wanted to ask Professor Brown if he's carrying a large debt load on credit cards and paying high interest rates on those credit cards and spending a lot of his money from that he makes towards that. Because what we're constantly told is, you know, don't carry a lot of personal debt. It's a bad idea. How does that correlate towards the large budget deficits that the country is now carrying?
And Andrew, you're suggesting that the federal budget deficit is a problem like those personal credit card debts.
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't make much sense if we're constantly being told don't have large personal debts. Why is it okay economically, you know, what I'm gathering from Professor Brown is that it's okay for the country to be carrying these large debts.
Andrew, we've got it. Stuart Brown, is it time for Uncle Sam to cut up some of those credit cards?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, we have to lower our budget deficit for a whole variety of reasons. But the connection with the current account deficit has to be brought out. You know, the current account deficit, another way of defining it, is the gap between savings and investment. And therefore,
though it's usually thought of as closer to the trade deficit, I mean, commonly.
Well, no, the current account deficit is largely the trade deficit,
mm-hmm.
And that is equivalent to the investment exceeding savings. Now,
right.
Savings includes the budget deficit. Unfortunately, the budget deficit represents dis-savings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the arguments is that we can rectify this problem by simply lowering the budget deficit. The problem with that is that the budget deficit and current account deficit have moved in different directions historically. And most of the studies that have been done on this have shown that, yes, it could have some minor impact if you lower the budget deficit on the current account deficit, but it would not be a major impact.
I want to ask you this, Stuart Brown. As I read your essay here, in something like the best case scenario, there's a tough economic patch that is kind of the cod liver oil, the tough medicine that gets things back in line. And the U.S. ends up on top, and it's not just tough for the U.S., but it's tough for most of the world. And the U.S. ends up on top because it's got some fundamentals that keep it there after everybody has taken a shellacking. Is that the best we can do? Is there no way, you know, that we could adjust our policy to avoid this global spanking?
Well, as I said, to the extent that the budget deficit has an impact on the situation, we should make that correction. But it's as a global economic problem, there are a lot of actors here. And the reason that we're in this mess, if you will, in this imbalanced situation, is not the sole contribution of the United States. I've tried to argue that that savings is excessive in other parts of the world. Other countries have to stimulate demand to help us get out of the situation. You know, it's also the case that U.S. consumers do not consume as much as what is suggested in the national accounts, and they also save more. They save more because they may save very little out of their disposable income, but they save in the form of their houses and 401ks and the equity market, all of which represent savings, but it's not captured in the data. So it makes sense in some sense to say, okay, I'm wealthier. Let me take less savings out of my income.
David's calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, David. You're on the air. Hello, my friend David. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's on your mind, David?
I like to say I definitely agree with Warren Buffett. We are heading for a meltdown. The rules of the game have changed. Our politicians are right now basing everything on Reaganomics, now an outdated way of doing things. Mm. Right now we're facing global competition from the European Union, and they're trying to knock us off our high seat, and it looks like it's going to happen. We're ignoring the threat, but right now there's a lot of anti-Americanism going on around the world, and people are trying to break the power of the last remaining superpower to make way for a one-world system. They see us as a threat to that, so the world's going to unite against us, and while we're weak, they're going to strike. We have the Europeans have been salivating for their chance, and now thanks to the current federal policies in Washington, they now have an opening.
And you think they may see it right now. David, thanks for calling. Robert Alibert, let me put it to you, both on the economic and the political front. David raises both and says, we're vulnerable now. Stuart Brown suggesting, yes, there are vulnerabilities, but the U.S. ends up on top in any scenario. There is no viable challenger to the kind of top spot on the pyramid. How do you see it? With these economic and political currents flowing in the face of the U.S. now, where does it take us?
Well, I think it's very dangerous to extrapolate that the U.S. will continue to be a high-productivity, high-growth country after the severe adjustment that is inevitable, that is the decline in the foreign exchange value of the dollar and the other measures that will be necessary to significantly reduce the U.S. trade deficit. Because of the severity of the adjustments abroad, we're going to have fewer friends abroad. The adjustments in many of these foreign countries are going to be more severe than in the United States.
Could you speak in more material terms about these adjustments? I'm not sure that I follow, or maybe some of our listeners. What do you mean by severe adjustments, practically speaking?
Sure. Several things are going to have to happen. We've been taking in foreign savings, $600-700 billion a year of foreign savings. That's displaced domestic savings. When the adjustment occurs, the U.S. savings rate, the amount that we save, is going to have to increase by $400-500 billion a year.
How will that happen? I mean, practical terms.
That will happen because interest rates will be much higher and people will be borrowing much less. They'll be saving much more. And it will be happening perhaps because corporate profits will be higher. It may happen because the U.S. government will use the shock, will understand that the shock means it must reduce the fiscal deficit.
I'm still trying to get this down to the sort of Joe six-pack or, you know, Joe six-cylinder level. You say that people will be saving much more and spending less. That hasn't been the American way. To an individual, how will that change of habit be introduced, happen?
Well, it will occur in response to the increase of interest rates. The ease of using credit cards will diminish. It will be much tougher to get loans for mortgages, much tougher to get loans for automobiles, the likelihood that you will have 0% financing. New car purchases will diminish very greatly. There will be some other adjustments. Some of the adjustments will be helpful. We're going to have the manufacturing base in the United States will be much stronger after the sharp decline in the foreign exchange value of the dollar.
How will it compete with China, where we've become accustomed to, it seems like, all manufacturing going to China? Why will it come back?
Well, if it doesn't come back, then there will be trade barriers that will limit Chinese exports to the United States to more or less the amount that China imports from the United States. The United States is a very strong country, but it's not sufficiently strong to be the engine of growth for all of Asia, and that's what it's been doing for the last 5 years.
Stuart Brown, you've said that it's exactly protectionism that would bring on a more severe outcome here. Robert Aliber is saying that may emerge as the only way to balance the budget, to balance the trade.
I think we very much have to avoid that that response, and it may be difficult. But I wanted to make one comment on Professor Aliber's several comments on manufacturing. You know, manufacturing output has held up rather well over a long period of time. It's manufacturing employment which is down. And manufacturing employment in the United States is down because of tremendous productivity growth. And we have moved into the much higher value-added sectors of that big branch of production. And we are exporting very different things today than we used to export.
But the trade deficit is still huge. It's a record level.
It's still huge, and it has to come down.
I want to ask each of you, our time is so short, and forgive me, but Stuart Brown, first to you, if we want to soften this blow, and you describe a blow as well, if we want to make it as soft as possible, if we wanted to take, you know, every possible step now to ease the impact of what's ahead, what would it be?
I would say at the same time that we are exhorting the Japanese and the Europeans to take the steps to grow faster, that we try to tackle our budget deficit. Not that that is going to be a panacea for the problem, but it may have some impact. And we should also adopt measures that will increase savings on the part of the population, although I do think that savings are higher than what they're measured.
And Robert Aliber, we've got a minute left. If you could prescribe the most important things to do to try and soften the blow you say is coming, what would they be?
We need to reduce government spending. We need to induce foreign countries to greatly increase their imports from the United States. We should be very cautious about reducing the fiscal deficit at this time because the adjustment that is going to be coming will have severe short-term implications for the employment rate. Unemployment will increase very significantly, and to reduce the fiscal deficit at this time will accelerate the increase in the unemployment rate.
We've got it. Jack Beadout, I must say, in both of these scenarios, the optimist and the pessimist, or however you want to describe it, they both sound like fasten your seatbelt friends. We're in for some rough sledding.
It does, and they do. And, you know, we were in a moment like this in the 80s when President Reagan sent his Secretary of the Treasury, Jim Baker, to the Plaza Hotel in New York with the meeting of the other industrialized nations. And they sort of came to an understanding that they were going to manage a rebalancing. Well, I'm not aware that anything like that is happening now. The Bush administration seems to be saying, what? There's nothing to worry about. This will all work. We don't need any management of this crisis.
Well, enough potential fallout for everybody here. I'm afraid we're out of time with that. Jack, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Robert Aliber, professor of international economics and finance at the University of Chicago, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Stuart Brown, thank you for your contrarian view and your time with us this evening.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Stuart Brown, professor of economics and international relations at Syracuse University. In a moment, one blogger's tale of joining the White House press corps. This is On Point. The world of blogging achieved another milestone today when, for the first time ever, a blogger was given a White House press pass. Garrett Graff writes for Fishbowl DC, a blog that covers the Washington media. Graff's inspiration to be the first blogger inside the White House? Jeff Gannon, the one-time White House press conference regular who quit his job with Republican-owned and operated Talon News after bloggers revealed his connection to gay websites. The White House claimed Gannon got through Secret Service scrutiny by using a renewable day pass. Garrett Graff wanted to see just how easy it is to get a White House day pass. He put the process to the test. In this radio diary, Garrett Graff describes what it was like to be the first legitimate blogger in the White House.
I started my quest for a White House press pass 2 weeks ago because there's been a lot of discussion in Washington in recent weeks in regards to the Jeff Gannon story where a reporter was found out to be representing a quasi, not really legitimate news organization under a pseudonym in the White House for the past 2 years. Jeff Gannon had gotten into the White House on what are called daily passes. They're passes that are designed for people who don't regularly cover the White House. And the White House had said when this came out that the day passes are very easy to get and that that any journalist who represents a legitimate news organization can receive one of these day passes. And one of the parts of the story that I set out to document was what exactly the process is to be determined by the White House as being able to cover it. So I started calling the White House last week, went through probably by week's end 20 or 30 phone calls to no avail. And then the president of the White House Correspondents Association, Ron Hutchinson of Knight Ridder, intervened last Thursday. He went and met with Scott McClellan, and he said, we think that this guy represents a legitimate interest in covering the White House and that he should be granted access. So I finally started to have some contact with the White House and got in for today's briefing. I showed up at the gate of the White House today, presented my driver's license. They checked to make sure that I was on the list, and I had a press credential, and I was inside in about 3 minutes. I was really, for lack of a better word, shocked at the working conditions that the journalists have there. The briefing room is very dilapidated and crowded and cramped, and then the area where the workspaces where the journalists spend their days are amazingly small. Most of them are no larger than a phone booth. And my second observation was I was really surprised at how little was accomplished in the briefings, how little the press secretary, Scott McClellan, sort of gave out, and how the reporters just end up asking the same question over and over and over again, trying to get a different answer, and generally failing. I had a lot of fun today, and the reporters, I think, had a lot of fun with me. There's an impression out there that bloggers are sort of the great unwashed masses who spend all day home on the couch in their pajamas drinking. And I presented a very good picture for the mainstream journalists today, and I did get some gentle teasing about the fact that I was wearing pants and dressed up and the anti-blogger in some respects like that. I think that the lasting impact from today is less that a blogger was admitted into the White House and more that it's sort of the next step in blogging maturing as a form of media, where sort of going from reporting on other people reporting about the facts, blogging is now moving towards a place where bloggers are going out and gathering information on their own and doing real reporting and becoming a part of the stories and the apparatus and the institutions of power that they cover. As a peace offering between myself on behalf of the blogosphere and the White House that I struggled vainly to get into last week, I brought cookies today, and I gave Scott McClellan a bag of cookies that I'd baked yesterday, and he in turn gave me a box of White House M&Ms. They've got the presidential seal and the president's signature on them.
Garrett Graff is editor of the blog Fishbowl, D.C. Today, he became the first blogger to cover a White House press conference. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.